Well, good morning. If you don't have a copy of the outline, please raise your hand. Men will get you one. You'll need one a little later. Also, we do have a few hundred more of the friendship books. If you didn't get a chance to get one last week, we did run out last week again. So you can get one in the lobby or the Book Resource Center. And today's going to be a little different than our normal message because we're going to be looking at a variety of passages in the book of Proverbs, so we're not going to land in one place. The book of Proverbs is a book that typically you don't preach through passage by passage, although we've done that before. It was one of the first books we went through when our church first started on a Wednesday night. But you typically study it thematically, pick a theme and run through the book because that theme is sprinkled throughout. So that's what we'll be doing today with the subject of friendship and from a negative perspective, as we'll see in a moment. So let me just give you a little word background, just a tad, because the Hebrew Old Testament has a variety of words for friendship. One of the most common, ria, is a word that often is translated neighbor or friend. It's a close person is literally what it means. So depending on the context, it could be either. And you'll notice that as we go through Proverbs, sometimes it'll be translated neighbor, sometimes friend, sometimes even like in Leviticus, brother, or your own people, are all those words are often used interchangeably. The most common word for friend, I mean, that's the most common. The most intense word for friendship is aluk, which is often used in the context of betrayal to highlight the pain of what was done, the treachery of what was done. For example, in Proverbs 2, the adulterous woman, quote, forsakes the alup, the companion of her youth, and forgets the covenant of her God. Their companion is a word for friend, or in this case, husband. And is parallel with forgetting the covenant of God through this treachery. In Psalm 55, King David highlights the agony of betrayal. Let me give you an example of this. Verse 13, "For it is not an enemy who taunts me. Then I could bear it. It is not an adversary who deals insolently with me. Then I could hide from him." You understand what he's saying? Like if it was somebody out there, it would be easier because I could just stay away from them or understand because an enemy you would expect to hurt you. But it is you. You see how emphatic that is. Like it's you of all people, a man my equal. Literally in the Hebrew, it's a man like me. In other words, we were friends. I saw you in me, and you saw you in me. I saw you in me, and me in you. We saw each other in each other. Like we were mirror souls. We were one, inseparable. And then the word alup, my companion, my alup, my close friend, my familiar friend. We used to take sweet counsel together within God's house. We walked in the throng. And what David is describing here is the reason why for many of us, when we talk about friendship, it evokes a polar response. Because when you look back at your life, you can see many of the highs you've experienced in your life are closely related to friends. Like you either experience them with your friends or because of your friends. But then, correspondingly, many of the lows in your life were either experienced with or because of friends. David knew what it was like to be betrayed by close friends. And what he's talking about here is not mere disappointment. It's not just something like, you know, I counted on you to come through for me, and you didn't come through for me, or you forgot my birthday. You know, that's teary, but that's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about intentional betrayal by someone you counted on. And the irony here is thick, because as David is describing this betrayal, he is also reminding us that while he has been betrayed by sons, by friends, he has also done what? He's betrayed. Think of a close, loyal friend of David's that he completely shafted. Uriah. Yeah, Uriah was a true loyal friend of David's, and he betrayed him on every level, leading to Uriah's death. And so even as we study friendship, we cannot, all these passages, and even David's lament about betrayal, point us forward to a friend who knows what it's like to be betrayed and yet has never betrayed. These passages point us forward to Jesus. I love the old song by Michael Card, and most of you young people have never heard of him. Like he wrote songs about the time of Isaac Watts. But one of his songs, titled Why, he is wrestling with this idea of betrayal, specifically Judas betraying Jesus. This is one of the paragraphs in the song. Only a friend can betray a friend. A stranger has nothing to gain. And only a friend comes close enough to ever cause so much pain. And this is why it's really scary when you talk about betrayal, because it's easy for us to build a wall around our hearts to try to protect ourselves from ever feeling that level of pain. And yet, this is why friendships are so vital, because friendships, again, point us to Jesus, who was betrayed in order to befriend betrayers. Like he came for us, the unfaithful ones. And God will manifest himself through our friendships. If we say no to friendship, we are saying no to God. Because we will experience and we will express the gospel in very real ways in the midst of friendships. Does that make sense to you? Like the gospel is not something that is just remote, ethereal, out there. It is right here in the midst of betrayal, in the midst of pain, in the midst of love and joy, friendship. David Crowder illustrates this in his life in a in this little video. Let's watch that.
I grew up in an incredibly, my parents were just really devout in their faith, so great Christian home. Growing up in church, you know, you have a certain posture that you present. It and school were kind of, it just always seemed to struggle to be who you were. But the great part is having really incredible friends. They were a part of my spiritual formation as much as my folks were. There's a little group of us that just really wanted to I don't know, follow this guy Jesus and figure out what that looked like and meant. I think my crisis of faith didn't hit me until about college. I think that's when I get out from under my parents and you inherit this faith, and then you've got to sort through. Your faith kind of bumps up against all these other ideas or outlooks on life and the world. And my college years really is where I sifted through the stuff that I had been carrying for a while and put aside what I felt like was keeping me from being who I was made to be, and picking up some new things that seemed to be where God was pushing me and pointing me. And, you know, I think we find God, you know, He reveals Himself in a number of ways, in nature and in scripture and history. And to me, when He's been most real and present, He's had flesh and bone. He's been the people that are near me. And the person closest to me is my wife. And when I've had my lowest points, when I've done something just absolutely ignorant, the way she has brought forgiveness and been forgiveness has been the most real thing I've felt of God. But to do something really just dumb and have somebody throw their arms around you and love you regardless is unbearable almost. Yet that's been when God has been the most real and present. And so I think it's paying attention to the people you're in relationship with. And when you're at the bottom, you'll find God popping up in real, living, breathing people around you.
Let's pray. Lord, that's really what we were asking for, is that we would see You more clearly right in the midst of broken, sometimes painful, often joyful friendships. That You would kill idols of friendship that we manufacture. That You would expose parts of our hearts that kill friendship, things we're doing even practically that are unhelpful. And in all of this, may we see Jesus. And we pray this in His name. Amen. So let's take a few minutes and talk about that. Really, we're going to come at it today from the negative side, that three friendship killers from the book of Proverbs. Next week, we're going to see the ingredients of friendship more from the positive side, what makes up good friendships. So you might be a bad friend if you are, number one, reactive. Reactive. And Proverbs comes at this from a lot of different angles. First of all, reactive to the person you're in friendship with. For example, in Proverbs 22, 24, and 25, make no friendship with a man given to anger, nor go with a wrathful man, lest you learn his ways and entangle yourself in a snare. So anger is one of the most contagious viruses on the planet. According to this verse, anger starts, spreads, and then snares. You guys know what that's like, right? You know, you're interacting with your friend about something could be very mundane. You know, we're going to go over here and get a cup of coffee, and no, why do you always get to choose where we go? And what? And before you know it, like, you're arguing over something really stupid. You ever have that happen? And when there's anger involved, because it's so contagious, the person who initiates the anger, it quickly spreads to the other person, who becomes very defensive and then counterattacks. And then before you know it, you're locked in this snare, is what Proverbs is saying. Like, you're stuck, and you feel like whatever I say, it's going to be wrong. Like, it's not going to help, because if I defend myself and try to explain what I really meant, that's going to make it worse. But if I'm quiet, this person's going to keep thinking what they're thinking and saying what. Do you know what he's? So Proverbs is saying, where there's anger, there it's going to be contagious, and it's going to end up putting a snare. over people, caught in a no-win. Proverbs 26, 18 and 19 says, like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbor or friend and says, I am only joking. So the parallel here is like a psychologically unstable terrorist is really the image there. Madman who throws firebrands, arrows, death. They're launching missiles. They're psychologically unstable. That's the correlation to a man who just shoots off his mouth or her mouth and then says, oh, did you get hurt by that verbal missile? I was just kidding. So the unbridled tongue is justified with laughter. This reactive tendency is not only to the person, but to other people. Proverbs 16:28, a whisperer separates close friends. Proverbs 17:9, whoever covers an offense seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates close friends. So a friend, Proverbs is describing a friend who's with you, is listening, asking questions, you know, I'm going to pray for you, but then they're reactive in the sense of when they're with you, they're for you, but then when they're with somebody else, they're going to trash on you. Which obviously destroys friendships. A third manifestation of this tendency to be reactive is in crisis. Proverbs 27:10, do not forsake your friend and your father's friend, and do not go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother who is far away. Now, the point here is not to trash on relatives, because Proverbs says the opposite in other places. The point is this, that better in the moment of crisis, better is a near neighbor or friend who is tested and true than a far relative who is relatively unknown. And a practical application of that is many of us paint pictures of friendship that are like airbrushed models on the front of magazines. You know, we have this image of what a friendship should look like that's not real. So when crisis happens, we pack up our suitcases and we're ready to go anywhere to find this model of friendship to meet our needs. And what Proverbs is saying, look near you. God has put people in your world that love you and that have been faithful to you, and they may not be cool. Hence, that's what he's talking about when he says, your father's friend. They may be old. You know, they're not going to be the kind of friend where you're like, I'm going to post this friend on Facebook because I'm friends with him. No, your friends may not be impressed at your friend. But what Proverbs is saying, that kind of friend is better than the ever elusive ideal friend that you think you need. This is a kind of friend that is multi-generationally proven, who will be there and tell you the truth and love you in a way that is truly helpful. Not just tickling your ears with the latest thing you want to hear. So God is saying, slow down. Don't be reactive in crisis. Don't be reactive with your tongue. In Proverbs, the reactive response is contrasted with a calm response. This isn't in your notes, but we'll throw up a little chart that illustrates this with a couple verses. A calm response hears, 18:13. Listens well before answering. A calm response cools, like a situation that is heating up. 15:1, a soft answer turns away wrath. A calm response persuades 25:15. Some of us think that if we respond calmly rather than reactively, then we're going to be weak. And Proverbs says the opposite. In 25:15, he uses two illustrations. One, that this calm response persuades a ruler and breaks a bone. The point is just the calm response, rather than being powerless, is actually powerful. It, in the end, accomplishes far more than the explosive or reactive response. I want to be that kind of friend, don't you? Not the friend, you know, who may be fun to have around at a party. But in a moment of crisis and in the long days of life, the reactive friend is often going to do more damage than good. But I am thankful to have several friends like this. I want to tell you about one of them, because you know him. I've known Ross Robinson for over 30 years. Can you believe that? We met when we were two. And we've ministered together now for 20 or so years. And there are so many times, especially, I'll just give you the kind of the ministry side, especially when there are moments of intense either decisions that need to be made, crisis that needs to be addressed, something like that, where you're put in a pressure cooker, you know, where you're, or times where we at times look at things differently and both have very different views as to what should happen. And there are times where I have just, you know, thinking out loud, shot my mouth out about, you know, hey, we should do this, or I think this or this. And there's so many times I can remember, I just have this picture of Ross's face. You know, his eyes are very engaged. His mind is obviously working quickly, but his mouth is not moving. In contrast to mine. Like, which one of these things are not like the other? And when the mouth starts moving, like the words are well thought through, and a helpful question, or he's seeking to clarify what I said, like as if to say, do you really mean what you just said? Are you crazy? No, he doesn't say that. But that calm response, you could just feel, not just settles things down. And I mean, I could give you hundreds of examples of that kind of thing, whether it's in elder meetings or just personal conversations over lunch or in the midst of whatever. And I want to be that kind of friend. And some of you have only known Ross for a little while. You just think he came out of the womb that way. But it is the grace of God. And he, I'm so glad he's not here right now, because he would be horrified to think that that had anything to do with him. He was known in Seneca, as in his high school, as the mouth of the South. His dad was telling me a great story last night that when he was four, they were driving from Greenville to Seneca, and Ross talked the entire time. Like the whole trip. And they got to Seneca, they pulled up at their house, and Ross said to his dad, my tongue is tired. I had never heard this story before. It's great. And his dad's like, yeah. So what happened? Well, he has shared with us before that when God began to convict him about his tongue, he did a study in the book of Proverbs about the tongue, and the grace of God began working and transforming, and it changed him. And then it affects me as a friend in the way he disciples me by his example, and it affects others and his family and friendships and community. And you can see it's the grace of God. We're not born good friends. Jesus changes us by his grace into good friends. So if we're not something, this isn't about personality. Yes, some of us are more talkative than others naturally, but that's not what this is about. This is the grace of God powerfully transforming a heart and that overflowing in the mouth. So number one, you might be a bad friend if you're reactive. Secondly, you might be a bad friend if you are insensitive. And by insensitive, I'm referring to a lack of awareness, which might be caused by ignorance or arrogance. Proverbs, again, looks at this from a couple different angles. 27:14, whoever blesses his neighbor with a loud voice rising early in the morning will be counted as cursing. Like, you get no credit for that blessing, pal. There's a couple different interpretations of this. One is hypocrisy. The volume and priority, volume, loud voice, priority, early in the morning, of the blessing is not supported by the reality. It's not a blessing. That's one interpretation. The other is the insensitivity. An obnoxious blessing is as if it were a cursing. Proverbs 25:20 picks up on a similar idea. Whoever sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day and like vinegar on soda. So this is an inappropriate response in a time of need. And sing songs is not referring to an appropriate lament or even a truth-filled song. But what he's talking about is a peppy song. You know, Lego movie, everything is awesome. That kind of song, which when you're in a low point in your life is absolutely grating. Even if you're in a high point, it's grating. I hated that. Proverbs 25:16-17. If you have found honey, eat only enough for you, lest you have your fill of it and vomit it. Let your foot be seldom in your neighbor's house, lest he have his fill of you and hate you. Do you see why I read both of those together? What's the key word? Fill. Yeah. Like, if you take your whole Halloween bag, you know, of candy, and you scarf all that down. Not that we would recognize Halloween, but if one would do that, if one would do that, and you eat all your candy for breakfast, Proverbs is saying there's a good chance it's going to come back out. You know, you're going to vomit it. And if you have a friend who doesn't know when to leave, you're going to feel like vomiting him out the front door. That's the parallel. You know, the fill of it. The idea here is how much is enough. So a good friend is sensitive about how much is enough. Like when it's time to stop talking or to leave. So with these all three together, a friend knows when to bless, when to sing, and when to leave. You might be a bad friend if you are reactive or insensitive. By the way, that isn't always instinctive. Good friends talk about these things. It's okay to say, can we talk about when you should leave? You know, they're able to talk about these things without offending one another. Okay, number three, you might be a bad friend if you are reactive, insensitive, or manipulative. Manipulative. Manipulation is attempting to control other people's behavior or emotions for your own purposes. 29:5, a man who flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. This is a form of manipulation. Like, what's coming out of the mouth is flattery, but the intention is very different. The, The purpose is very, very different. 19, 6 and 7. Many seek the favor of a generous man, and everyone is a friend to a man who gives gifts. All a poor man's brothers hate him. How much more do his friends go far from him? He pursues them with words, but does not have them. So in this case, the friendship is built on the possession of or destroyed by the deficiency of money, which is obviously a false foundation of friendship. So in both of these cases, the friend has a hidden agenda and tries to accomplish his ends through manipulative means. Now, manipulation comes in a variety of forms. Let me suggest two here. First of all, there is active manipulation, which is control through intimidation. And this could be intellectual, physical, verbal, or emotional intimidation. And this kind of manipulation is so difficult to identify, or for the person who is manipulating, to identify and to change, primarily because it doesn't feel like manipulation. What do I mean by that? Now follow me here. Like if I'm intimidating somebody, seeking to control them through intimidation, often the manipulating person is very insecure. Like the manipulation is driven by a feeling of insecurity. They feel out of control. So they are doing, they're intimidating, but they feel like the victim. Does that make sense? So when, even though they're intimidating somebody or seeking to control somebody physically, verbally, emotionally, it doesn't feel that way to the person because they're driven often, not always, but driven by insecurity, fear, or a feeling of being out of control. So when you try to confront a person like that, they don't get it at all because they feel like the victim. Like, you made me do that. Like, what reasonable person wouldn't have tried to control the situation because you made it out of control? It's your fault. So you can see why a manipulator is so often immune to conviction. Because even when the Spirit is knocking on your door saying, hey, like, your craving to control is destroying your marriage. It is killing your kids. It is wiping out your friendships. To the person who's hearing that knock's not for me. That knock's for her or him. Control through intimidation. Second form of manipulation is the inversion, that is passive, control through neediness. It's often fueled by the same sense of insecurities. There are some of us who need to be needed and will use not an overt power intimidation, but a sickness or crisis to seek to control or influence people. This can come in such a variety of forms. Even a mom whose kids are grown and then they're having their own marriages, and just that feeling of I don't feel needed anymore. And it's really easy to jump in the middle of situations and try to fix them in order to get another hit, like to feel needed. Or a woman who fears being alone and therefore has to create a crisis for the purpose of trying to keep people near, lest she feel alone. It's all a form of manipulation, and it sucks the life out of true friendship. So you might be a bad friend if you are reactive, insensitive, manipulative. There are many other examples in Proverbs. We'll stop there. Let's just take a few minutes to take, I know you've been dying to take a friendship killer quiz. You can take this out of your bucket list. So let's take a moment, and I would encourage you to force yourself to say yes or no. It's going to be hard. But it could be really helpful. Do your friends feel uncomfortable confronting you? And you say, how would I know? Well, how would I know? They never do. Light bulb moment. Might just wondering if that's a breadcrumb you could follow. So, yes or no? Like, do you give them permission to, when appropriate, share their concerns, confront, speak truth? And even when you give permission, it has to be, like, sincere. Otherwise, they're going to pick up on, I'm hearing the words, but I ain't going there. Secondly, do you get angry with your friends? And I don't mean by this, have you ever gotten angry? But does anger characterize your friendship? And remember, anger comes in more forms than yelling, pouting, withdrawal, or the cold shoulder are all forms of anger. They just come in nice forms and naughty forms. But does anger characterize your friendships? Thirdly, do you talk negatively about your friends or break their confidence? And again, this is a hard one to identify because there's times where our mouth is flapping and we say things we don't mean to say, but do I fairly regularly speak negatively about a friend? Yes or no? Are your friendships short or shallow? And it's not meant to pick one or the other. It may be both. It may be one. By short, I mean, do you have long-term friendships or are they seasonal? And shallow. You know, how do I know if my friendships, my Christian friendships, are shallow? One way, one indicator is, like, think of a close friend and then think, if I prayed with that friend right now, would they have a sense that they were really prayed for? Like, more than just bless my friend, take care of him, take care of his kids, help his team to win tonight. You know, but that you really know what's going on in his or her heart, what the latest burdens are. Because when you get together, yeah, you do have fun, but you also can talk about heart. Next one, are you ignorant of the things that you do that bother your friends? Yeah, that's another one. That's the very people who need to say yes here are going to be like, no, right? Because we're ignorant. So ask for the Spirit's wisdom on that one. Like, do I have a sense about, are there things that I used to do that I realized were unhelpful to my friend that I seek by the Spirit's power not to do anymore? That might be a clue that there's a sensitivity there. Do you ever intimidate your friend? What I mean by intimidate is, do you need to be in charge, consistently correct, use humor to belittle, or threaten? Like, you need to be the one that makes the decision. You need to be in control of the situation. You need to know the answer to the question. All of those are forms. That can be a little intimidating in a friendship. Like, can you chill out a bit, friend? Finally, do you feel anxious when you are not needed by your friend? And one of the ways you'll know this This will pop up often when your friend is out with other friends. And that feeling like, how dare he? Like, she knows my number. Why didn't she call me? So very, like, overly possessive. So, how'd you do? look over those yeses, and I want you to do something now. Ask the Spirit to show you which yes is most convicting. I know some of you aren't going to want to mark them at all because it's like, don't want my neighbor peeping at my quiz. That's against the rules. You're cheating. Okay, then in your mind's eye, as we've walked through a few of these proverbs, just surveyed some of the friendship killers, was there one area where the Spirit put his finger and just said, let's start here. Let's start here. And you might just put a star next to that one. Just saying, okay, I hear you. Like I hear you. And I know some of us have, if we do them all, we're going to have a lot of stars. But just one. Just one. Do you know which one? Like, do it. Don't just look at me. I'm feeling insecure. And now, how does the gospel relate to this starred failure, weakness? You say, well, what is the gospel? How does the coming, the living perfect, a perfect life, the being betrayed, the dying on the cross, the rising from the dead of Jesus, how does that connect to this friendship failure of mine? And I'm really tempted to answer that question, like go through all of these, and I think that would be entirely unhelpful. Like right now, let's take a few minutes. Ask the Spirit of God. Imagine who Jesus is and what he did as a friend who was betrayed to give his life for betrayers, for friendship failures. And say, Jesus, like, what does your coming and dying and rising have to do with this area of my marriage, my life, my friendship, my interactions with my coworker or roommate, or like, what does this have to do with that? So let's take a few minutes. We'll have some music playing. Just go before the Lord. Ask the Spirit for that kind of insight.